Well, thank you very much, everyone, for coming. Thanks, Dimo, for inviting me. Yes, I have to admit that I didn't expect to wake up at 4. So if I'm not completely coherent, just I apologize. I hopefully won't fall asleep, but sometimes I can use wrong words or whatever. So I will essentially talk about two works which I would never expect it myself be related, and they might seem unrelated, but hopefully I'll show that they are. So one is about like geometry of quantum phases, which is in a sense like equilibrium work, and another about emergent numerical Newtonian dynamics, which is non-equilibrium. So first half of the work was largely done with Michael Drubitz, postdoc and BU, and second part of the work was done with Luca D'Alessio. So I would very much welcome any questions during the talk. So this is basically the outline. I first introduced the notion of geometric tensor. Of course, everyone I assume knows that there is a Berry curvature, but probably fewer know what's the Fubini study metric tensor, so I'll introduce this. Then I'll talk about a particular example, quantum XY chain, and I'll describe its geometry, and hopefully what we learn from this are some generic statements. But because I'm making like two talks in one, I'll be sort of skipping lots of details of the calculations, so showing pictures, and if at the time things are not clear, just really stop me or we can talk afterward. And then I will switch gears and I will talk about non-adiabatic expansion for macroscopic degrees of freedom. And it turns out that we'll see that Newtonian dynamics is really emergent. So you, it just, if you want, comes from statistical physics. And the mass, like one of the basic notion of Newtonian dynamics, plays the role of, emerges from this geometric tensor. And also, like very generically, I will show that Coriolis force is always Berry curvature. And if I have time, I will talk about, like, if you want, a CU2 quantum Hall effect. So the idea is very simple. So let's imagine that we have to be specific, ground state manifold, but it doesn't have to be ground state manifold. At some time, I'll switch to finite temperature density matrices, but just to be specific. So we have ground state of manifold. So what it means? It means we have some Hamiltonian which parameterized by some parameters. So say, like here, if you have spin and magnetic field, these parameters can be like theta and phi component of the magnetic field. They can be pressure, they can be, I don't know, some shape distortion, so angle opposition in space, if you think about moving in space. And the question is, can we define some associated geometry? And the answer was given by Provost and Wally in 1980, they introduced the notion of the geometric tensor. And physically, it defines distance between family of states, like here, family of ground state, if we slightly change the parameter. So how much, in other words, how much wave function changes if we change parameter a little bit? So just to be a little bit more specific, and I want to apologize. So at points, the talk will be a little bit technical, but then I will be again non-technical. So since it's theory talk, I thought I will include some slides with formulas, but not too many. So let's assume that we have family of Hamiltonians, and we have family of wave functions. And then we can make a simple thing. So let's assume that we change parameter a little bit, and then we ask what's the distance between these wave functions. We want, of course, gauge invariant distance because we can multiply this function by arbitrary phase. So, and basically a natural distance is just overlap of the old ground state and new ground state, sometimes called fidelity. And well, because this is clearly positive definite, then in the lowest order of perturbation theory, we should get some second order expansion with some positive definite matrix, chi alpha beta. And this is what Provost and Wally called denoted as geometric tensor. So in simple words, this geometric tensor is just overlap between derivatives of this wave function. And it's connected, so we just want to subtract this whatever phase, overall phase rotations. So it's a very simple object. Well, we can also see that there is an interesting structure of this object, because we can say that this derivative is actually a gauge potential. And we can think about this, if you want, that there is some unitary evolution operator which adiabatically connects my different ground states. We call it U. And then it's clear that, well, the derivative d by d alpha, it will have this form, right? So U dagger is just to project to rotated state, and d alpha U is because my psi naught will be U and psi. So this is like a gauge potential. And then geometric tensor is nothing but the connected correlation function of this gauge potential. So this will be important because you understand immediately that if you talk about translations in real space, this is real momentum operator. If you think about rotations, this is angular momentum operator. But you can think about motion in arbitrary parameter space. So, and then it can be complicated, many-body operator. It's interesting that in original paper, so Provost and Volley, they introduced it, but they immediately sort of put down the value of their work by saying that one is not interested in local properties of the manifold of states, but physically relevant things are transition probabilities. And I'll try to convince you that they were wrong, and this object is extremely interesting. So, but first, let me just say that this abstract object is something like physically measurable susceptibility. So in a sense, you can just go to the lab. You don't need to do anything fancy. You just measure what you usually measure. You just slightly differently analyze the result. And we can see it from sort of the following thing. So this metric tensor is like overlap between derivatives, and this is like this matrix element. You differentiate eigenstate m with respect to lambda, project to n. And then, well, we know from first order of perturbation theory it's equal to this. So I said that this gauge potential is a complicated operator, but its matrix elements are simple. This is just matrix elements of derivative of the Hamiltonian divided by energy moment. And because of this, this geometric tensor is written as sort of this sum. So this energy denominator squared comes from this. And then we can use Lemon representation. Maybe it's a little bit too fast, but you can imagine that this is just integral of E, whatever, En minus E0 t. And I need extra t because I want energy squared. So in other words, this is just integral of some correlation function. It's a well-defined object. We can go to frequency space. Then this becomes 1 over omega squared. And s alpha beta is our standard susceptibility. So just usual frequency response. So it's some green function with name which I don't remember. So if you want symmetric part, then symmetric part becomes symmetric part of this correlation function. And somewhere in the back of our minds, we remember there is fluctuation dissipation theorem. And if we talk about equilibrium systems, and now I can extend it to any temperature, it can be zero temperature or finite temperature, then this will be nothing but imaginary part of susceptibility divided by omega squared multiplied by whatever this hyperbolic tangent. At zero temperature, this is just one. So this metric tensor is measurable. You just look into imaginary part susceptibility, divide by omega squared, and integrate. So it means that whatever I tell later, it might look very abstract, like pictures, some complicated mathematics, but it's all measurable in the lab.
So are you assuming time translation invariance?
Well, this is so far just no dynamics. This is a ground. Time is, by the way, it's my Lemon representation. It's a fake variable. But in linear response, this is precisely what appears.
Sure, but the form of S alpha beta as a function of omega sort of assumes that this translation invariance, right, for time?
Well, it's by definition because, well, if you want, I define it with respect to stationary density matrix. You can probably define this object with respect to non-stationary state, but then it's a question. I don't know what.
It's a question of detail.
Well, that's more interesting, but let's look at this. So an imaginary part, of course, you know, imaginary part of this geometric tensor is just usual Berry curvature. And we know it's measurable. So I'll comment about general sort of properties of how you measure it in the end of the talk. But we know it's Lorentz force, Coriolis force, Hall conductivity. There are lots of examples. So this is definitely measurable in experiment. And this appears in Kubo response.
I think my question is related to Luis's. So what's entropy?
Oh, this is just Heisenberg representation. Sorry, there is no dynamics. It's just by definition, e to the minus I h t d lambda h. So this is your susceptibility, and it's e to the I h t. So this is just Heisenberg representation of your generalized force. I first take the derivative, sorry. D lambda H is really generalized force. So if lambda is magnetic field, this is magnetization. Yeah. Otherwise, there is no time dependence, of course. Yes, so I guess I should, I should put brackets here. It's D lambda H as a function of T. Good. So now let's take some simple example, like spin and magnetic field. So we know what the ground state is. So it's just, some combination of cosines and sines. And then maybe even in your head, you can just do calculations. So like high theta theta will be derivative with respect to overlap of derivative with respect to theta, high phi phi, high theta phi. So you can compute. And then, as I said, symmetric part of this is a metric tensor. And you might recognize immediately that this is a metric of a sphere with radius 1/2, which makes perfect sense. So if you ask, what's the manifold of states of a spin and magnetic field, which can change angles, might look like, well, just a sphere, it must be. And that's indeed a sphere. And in general, this 1/2 is S over 2. And of course, we know that Berry curvature gives to the Berry phase. And I'm not going. Now, we can talk about geometric invariance. And of course, like this Chern number is like the most famous, which appears everywhere. It's integral Berry curvature, which is quantized. But we also know from geometry that there is another number, which is called Euler characteristic, which really measures number of holes. And in general, it's integral of, say, Gauss curvature, which is just function of the metric. It's a complicated function, but it knows only about metric, only about real part. And if you have manifold with a boundary, there is an extra term which tells us how close the boundary to geodesics. And the formulas are very complicated. I don't remember them, but they are available in Wikipedia. So that's important. So the question is, can we use this Euler characteristic to characterize phases and phase transitions? Not by Chern number, but by this one. And can we define like new geometric invariants? And I will try to partially answer these questions. So and as I said, instead of going into generalities, I will use specific model, but then I will argue that at least lots of the statements are really generic. So this is like XY chain in magnetic field. I'm sure like many of you, maybe most of you know it. So it maps to free fermions using Jordan-Wigner transformation. So it has two parameters. One is anisotropy. It just tells you whether XX interaction or YY interaction is bigger. And another is magnetic field. And this phase has a well-known phase diagram. So when H is big, it's like usual paramagnet. So it's just non-interacting spins and magnetic field. When H is small, it's a ferromagnet, because this dominates. And you can have two types of ferromagnets. So if XX interaction dominates, it's like XX ferromagnet. If YY, it's YY ferromagnet. And there is a point where there is no preference between X and Y, and there is what's called anisotropic transition. But it.
The minus sign goes entire.
It's just because it's ferromagnet. Oh, sorry. Yeah. I apologize. There should be brackets here. Yes.
It's a whole minus sign.
Yes, it's a whole minus sign. I have two sums. So it's just, it's the minus sign before the sum. But it's actually not the whole story, as there is another very interesting state, which we first thought is nuisance, but then we realized it's very real. And this is like fully polarized, or as like my high energy friend told me, it's asymptotically free space state. it's a state with vanishing instead of divergent susceptibility. And it's very easy to understand that the state is sort of generic in this case. Because let's just look into state h goes to infinity. When h goes to infinity, well, it's clear then the state is just eigenstate of sigma z, all states are polarized. Now, along this line, you have symmetry of rotations along z direction. So it means that the state is always eigenstate of sigma z. But it's the only ground state. So it immediately see that this can be only fully polarized state. Because you start from fully polarized state, it must commute with a z, so you cannot mix any other states, and it's the only one. So until you reach critical point where gap vanishes, you will have this fully polarized state, which will be protected by all sorts of terms which don't break symmetry. And it's asymptotically free, because if you go a little bit away from this state, so here, it will be still free at UV. So you will still have vanishing susceptibilities at UV. Good. OK, so now let's try to look into geometry of this phase. So I'll just sketch roughly how calculations go without, of course, going into details. So as I said, this model maps to free fermions, and therefore its ground state can be written as product of states in momentum states. Each of them is like spin 1/2 particle. And then we can find this gauge potential. So basically operators which are translate us along h direction or phi direction or whatever gamma direction. So and in this case, they're relatively simple. So like if you look carefully, if you change theta, it's like doing rotation in y-axis. Therefore, this gauge potential is proportional to tau y with a different k-dependent weight. And phi rotation, you can just convince yourself it's a combination of z and x. So these are your gauge potentials if you want these momentum operators. So you explicitly know them. Now you can calculate connected correlation functions, and you do the integrals, and then you find some analytic expressions. So in particular, if you look into HH component of this metric tensor, so how wave function changes if you change this magnetic field a little bit, you just see that it diverges near one transition, gamma goes to zero, it's an isotropic transition, and it diverges near the other transition from ferromagnet to paramagnet when H is equal to one. So it's some divergent quantity. And the question, what is next? Well, geometry is tough. So the easiest way to understand geometry is to try to embed this thing in a three-dimensional space. So let's try to do it. So the idea is that we will try to find local coordinates such that dz squared plus dr squared plus r squared d phi squared is the same as my distance here. So that's what really embedding is. And for this situation, it's possible. Again, I'm skipping the details, but that's the answer. It's sort of very nice shape. It's a cylinder covered with two semispheres. That's what this metric gives. So this is, if you want, just exact representation of the geometry of the sizing model in H phi planes. I forgot. We always take two-dimensional cuts, because otherwise I cannot visualize and it's too complicated. And then what happens is that there are still two different phases. Paramagnet corresponds to a semisphere, ferromagnet to a cylinder, and there is another paramagnet which corresponds to another semisphere. Now we can ask, what about Euler characteristics? Well, Euler characteristic of this object is trivial. It's 2, because it's isomorphic to sphere. But it's actually, it turns out that this 2 is non-trivially split between phases. So this 2 consists of 1 from half of the sphere, 0 coming from a cylinder, there's no curvature, and another one. And it turns out that this is already protected. So even if you make very, very complicated version of this model, as soon as it has same transition, and as soon as you terminate your line at the transition, then you will get this 1, 0, 1. So 1 is not topological invariant, but it's geometric invariant. And the reason it's protected is sort of intuitively very simple. Because as I said, so what is protected for shape with boundary is bulk term plus boundary term, but boundary term sits at phase boundary. Therefore, you can imagine it's universal. So that's the reason why boundary term is protected. Good, we can now look into a different situation. So what about gamma phi cut? So remember, gamma is an isotropic parameter and phi is an angle again. In gamma phi plane, it actually looks like we are piercing our plane. So think about gamma phi plane. So I have a plane and transition happens at gamma equals to zero. So at radius equals to zero. So it's like a situation when you cut your phase diagram with a plane such that transition line piercing it. So it sort of looks like this if you look into the metric. So these are like equidistant planes, equidistant contours. So there is a transition at this point. And away from the transition, there are some drawn nice equidistant contours. It's not really important what it is.
Is there Hamiltonian in an open line or on the ring?
It doesn't really matter. Well, we consider it on the ring, but it's not important. I'm talking about global geometry of the whole phase. So everything is extensive.
Yes? I'm just wondering if you could think of that each day I find that introduced by hand as some kind of boundary condition.
No, I forgot to mention. You can say it's by hand, but it's really there because you can have X ferromagnet or Y ferromagnet, but you can imagine you can have ferromagnet in looking under 45 degrees. So the symmetry is always implicitly there.
But if you study the model in terms of twisted bond,
it's a global.
Do you know if that?
No, but I'm not introducing phase gradient. So you're asking what will happen if your parameter is a gradient. It's like a current. I don't know. I have to think. It's another part. You see, it's like with phase diagram. So number of parameters, it's really up to you. So you can define geometry with respect to this current. Yes, but we didn't look at it yet.
So I guess it's related. If I added another term that doesn't change the nature of the transition, but just change. So do you expect if I took a cut at a value of the parameter, it always has the same geometry, like simply deformed? The phase boundary?
No, geometry, yeah, so no, geometry will change for sure. Because the fact that it's cylinder, it's really fine tuning. But it will change sort of in a way that your geodesic, so if this is my, say, two-dimensional cut, so I just said that geometry looks like, I don't know, essentially like a rectangle here, and then it's half a sphere. So geometry will change, but in sort of way that it always enters under 45 degrees. And there is even simple reason to this, because metric really tells you about how fast wave function changes. And if you go along relevant perturbation, it changes a lot. So it actually means that effectively, even if you, in your phase diagram, so in your parameter space, you are crossing transition like this, from the point of view of metric, you're always crossing it like this. Because distance, you see, along irrelevant or marginal direction, distance almost, I mean, it's small. But along this direction, you change h a little bit, and you are done.
Generically, whether this phase should be gapped, is that right?
Well, if it's gapped, well, I would say. So if it's gapless, it becomes really interesting. So, well, but you see, critical points are gapless. So I just showed you example. So this is like metric is divergent here, that in a sense that. GHH diverges and whatever, but it's removable divergence. Because this divergence, you can just say that square root of h minus 1 times whatever dh squared is my new dxi squared,
so the
and so on.
So the matrix is regular for the gap phase.
Yes.
At the gapless point, maybe there are singularities.
Yes, and this is like a very simple singularity, whereas a curvature jumps. So we didn't find universality here, but I'll show you another singularity. Yeah, right. So this is like gamma phi plane. So as I said, so think about this. So you have some plane, and then your phase transition penetrates through it. And then you think what kind of singularity it can correspond to. And then you can immediately figure out it should be conical singularity. That's the only way. And that's indeed what happens. So if we are in this ferromagnetic phase, where remember, there is transition at gamma goes to zero, then we have some, you know, spike here. It's like really a cone. And then you can define, again, bulk Euler characteristic. So it means that total Euler characteristic is, again, trivial. It's one in this case, but anyway, because it's one half of the two. But you can say, what's the limit of bulk characteristic if you go all the way to the tip without touching the tip? And it turns out that there is a number which is 1 over square root of 2. And that's completely universal. So for this transition, we can even understand it's a combination of some anisotropy. So as you see, the circle is somewhat anisotropic. And some critical exponents. And it's interesting that critical exponents are not universal, because you just say that, let's say, square root of lambda is new parameter. Then alpha becomes double alpha. But it turns out that anisotropy also changes by sort of amount. And this is completely universal. And moreover, we check numerically that if you distort model completely, you just introduce some, I don't know, phi-dependent terms, you break all the symmetries, this number is still universal. So we cannot really prove it mathematically, but it's a universal number. And as I said, again, it's measurable. So I'm closer to the end of this part. So now you can say, what about gamma H plane? Remember, gamma anisotropy H magnetic field. It's just very hard to visualize. So we tried, and it's very, very crazy. It turns out that embedding problem is complicated by itself. It's not always possible, and so on. So, but then we can just look straight into curvature, Gauss curvature. And then we just see that, yes, there are transitions. So this is an isotropic transition when diverges. This multicritical point in diverges. And it's interesting that it's non-integrable curvature singularity. So you can show. So this is like, I don't know, at least in high energy physics, they talk about curvature singularities, what happens in the center of black hole or something like that. So, and then you cannot really define Euler characteristic because it diverges. But the way how it diverges may be something universal. So I talked about this very briefly about this asymptotically free state. So remember, it's basically fully polarized state. It just turns out that, again, very generically, you can prove that locally you can map the metric to a plane. So this is not really a property of this particular model. And therefore, there is no curvature singularity. But still, this mapping is very singular, because you can imagine that this is one line corresponds to one state, one point. And then you can imagine that metric, if it's flat, should look something like that. That's actually true. And it's actually still, if you look into some other Ricci curvature, it's still singular. So, but since we don't understand why it is important, we don't want to talk about this. OK, so this is all nice. And then we can ask, why shall we care about the metric? And this is really a second part of my talk. So I'll now completely switch in gears. And hopefully, by the end of the talk, I'll make the connection. And this was, as I said, an expected connection. Well, I mean, switching gears completely, but not quite, because I still, now I want to consider dynamics where I have some macroscopic degree of freedom, same lambda, I use the same notation, which is coupled to our system. But now I want to treat this degree of freedom as a dynamical degree of freedom. So it's not really external field. So think about magnetic field, which can change in time. Well, typically, this magnetic field comes from some, I don't know, torsion oscillator, oscillations of some magnet or whatever, oscillations of current in loops or whatever. And usually we treat those as big fields and so on. But let's for a second pretend that this is dynamical degrees of freedom itself. So it actually means that dynamics of lambda is not prescribed a priori. And let's assume that our Hamiltonian consists of some simple part, H naught. At the end, I can absorb H naught to H without loss of generality. This is just to build intuition. And H naught will be some, I don't know, degree of freedom in external potential. So something like that. And then there is H, which depends on lambda. So, and if we send mass to infinity in this picture, it's really like doing with external field. So it's infinitely massive degree of freedom. And let's just start from non-stationary state and see what happens. So that's the idea. Now, how we approach it? Well, we'll try to assume that this field is slow and try to build adiabatic perturbation theory in velocity. So we treat velocity as a small parameter. Well, it's intuitively clear that if velocity is small, it means we're nearly adiabatic. So it's easier to go to moving frame. So let's try to go to a moving frame. I'm using the same U, which I used in the very first slide, just meaning adiabatic rotations. So I want to do this rotation to a moving Hamiltonian. And basically, it means that my transformed Hamiltonian is a very simple object. It's just diagonal matrix, which eigenstates which might change in lambda. But it's diagonal matrix. But it's clear that I will have to pay price because my lambda now depends on t. And therefore, when I substitute this into Schrodinger equation, I will get du dt, which is du d lambda times the lambda dt. And because I need to multiply everything by u dagger, just to get equation for psi, otherwise there will be extra u here, I just realized that I get my gauge potential, the same gauge potential which I introduced. And moreover, I stress that if alpha translations, this is momentum operator, because you might recognize this is just Galilean transformation. Because if I move in space, you know that Hamiltonian becomes h minus v times p. That's precisely what I'm writing. But now my p is generator, is like gauge potential, generator of translations in the parameter space. And it's proportional to velocity. So in adiabatic limit, it vanishes. So therefore, I can use it as a perturbation. And that's the idea. So now what I'm doing is just doing second. Now I'm skipping all the details, and I'll be happy to share them. But basically, I'm doing standard second order perturbation theory in this, just time dependent perturbation theory. And the only thing I'm using, as I said, A is complicated many body operator, but I'm using this property that it's matrix element, as I showed, matrix element of d lambda dh divided by energy denominator. That's all I need. I don't need any other properties. And it turns out that in the leading order in velocity, you get the following result. So that energy change consists of this adiabatic term. So it's just because you change parameters, your energy levels change without sort of transitions. And that's standard thermodynamic force. So this is like, if you remember, d lambda h is minus generalized force. But then there is extra term, which is due to transitions. And this extra term can be written in the following form. And this is, again, Heisenberg representation with respect to static Hamiltonian. So I already removed all dynamics from the system. And OK. So now the idea is very simple. So let's just expand. So it's non-local in time. But if my lambda is slowly changing field, I can just do Taylor expansion in time. So it means that this lambda dot of t minus t prime is the first order is just lambda dot of t. In the next order, it will be lambda double dot times t prime, and so on and so forth. And then I integrate everything. And then I find something which is quite simple, that energy change is equal to basically lambda dot squared times one tensor. And this is drag or dissipation. So you might recognize that this is just drag form. And there is like microscopic expression for it. And actually, several people before, I think Berry and Robbins were first to obtain it. But then there is another term, which looks like total derivative of lambda dot squared. So why don't we call it a mass term? And this is, in short, is just expressed through this gauge potential. It's just imaginary time integral of this connected correlation functions of this gauge potentials. And then we can see that this is indeed a mass term. Because remember that our h is h naught plus whatever h of lambda. Total energy is conserved. So we just say d dt is equal to 0. So this will be dh naught dt, which is just lambda dot times m times lambda. Sorry, there should be lambda beta. I apologize. Lambda beta double dot. Then there will be a force coming from h naught. And then there will be terms which are dh lambda dt. And those terms are exactly computed for you. So one will be kappa, and then we immediately see that this is indeed renormalization of mass. Then there will be dissipation. And then there will be extra contribution to the force. So now we can divide by lambda dot, and what we get is basically dissipative Newton's equation. Now, we can say, but wait, can type sorb H0 into H? So let's forget about H0. H0 doesn't exist. So H is the only thing we have. Then actually, this is not renormalization of mass. This is just a mass. So this is the mass, and it's related to this. Well, this is exact definition. But let's look what happens in classical limit. If you want, this is inertial mass. This is the definition of inertial mass. But let's look in the classical limit. In classical limit, or high temperature limit, it's where imaginary time integral sort of, well, beta is sort of small. That means that instead of this integral, like in normal statistical physics, I put beta times whatever is left, and whatever is left is exactly the metric tensor. Now this is the connection. So it doesn't quite work for the ground state. Mass is slightly different than metric. But in the classical limit, mass is just inverse temperature times the metric tensor. That means whenever we see any damped sort of harmonic motion, so this coefficient is the mass, and it's related to metric. So let's just make sure that results make sense. Let's consider a free particle in space. Then, as I said, gauge potential with respect to translational motion is just momentum. So I'm just telling you something which we all know. I'm telling about equipartition theorem. I'm just telling you that mass is inverse temperature times average of p squared. So this formula at least makes sense, but I just want to highlight there are no assumptions whatsoever about how strong interactions are, quantum, classical. Well, we can extend this to many degrees of freedom. Again, I'm skipping details of the calculation, and they're actually already on archive. It's just slightly more complicated. And it turns out that you find a more general form of the Newton equations. I would say most general form. You still have this mass tensor, which is off-shell. It turns out you have also antisymmetric part, which is dissipative, correction to the dissipation. Then you have this dissipation, which I wrote before. But also you have extra thing, which is Berry curvature. And if you stare at this term for a second, you recognize that this is your Coriolis force. So Coriolis force is just given by Berry curvature, and this is just a commutator of your gauge potential expectation. Well, it's true at finite temperature, zero temperature, any temperature. So these two guys, F and kappa, they're non-dissipative. It turns out there is alternation. By the way, if we go to third derivatives, we didn't check it, but I'm sure we'll find dissipation by light. This expansion continues. So it's also always alternate. So in first derivative, antisymmetric tensor is off-shell. It's non-dissipative. And in the second order, it's symmetric part, which is off-shell, which is non-dissipative. Then it will be again antisymmetric and so on. It just comes from the fact that integral of 0 to infinity dt is just has principal value and imaginary part. And they sort of alternate, symmetric, antisymmetric, and so on. So it means that if we look into, say, small temperature limit or vacuum in the sense that there are very, very few excitations, then this term is just very, very small, or zero, while this term are finite just because they're off-shell. They can be zero if, say, we have time reversal symmetry, but in general, there is no reason for them to be zero. Off-shell terms are determined by virtual processes. So it means they're always finite. So at small temperatures, we just recover standard Newton's equations or whatever. I mean, these are Euler equations, and I even suspect that Maxwell equations are also described by this. So, and we see that macroscopic classical Coriolis force is actually very interesting, can be used to extract Schur number. Because my lambda, my macroscopic degree of freedom is classical, that's what you measure. But my F is not, it might come from the ground state. Now let me just show you I guess a very simple example. So let's imagine that you have some classical, it's like central spin model in some sense. We have a classical rotator, so this thing which can sort of rotate in all directions, coupled to, say, spin 1/2 systems. Let's just look at this. And We can write some self-consistent dynamics. So we treat this n. N is like your classical rotator. It's the direction of this rotator. It's classical degree of freedom. So we can write self-consistent dynamics for these guys. I mean, it's still complicated. You can solve it numerically, but you can also do this non-adiabatic approximation, assuming that rotations are slow. And if you do this, you recover your whatever standard equations for rotator, but with renormalized mass, so with renormalized moment of inertia. So it's basically, I didn't say it here, but I mean, you can show that it's actually I plus kappa plays the role of moment of inertia. And this is precisely this guy. And you also have a Coriolis force, which is given by Berry curvature. And you see that at zero temperature, and this guy, unlike this guy, is really quantized. It's 1/2 times number of integers, number of spins. And if you just simplify a little bit and ask, so what happens in the equatorial plane? These are complicated equations. Then they are very, very simple. And then you just see that this Coriolis, this Berry curvature is indeed a Coriolis force. So what happens is the following. So suppose my rotator starts rotating like this, slowly. Then what happens is that spins start, say, from the ground state to be precise. Spins try to follow. But because I'm moving with some speed, they're slightly behind. If they're slightly behind, they want to precess. So they start to tilt. But because they want, but they cannot precess because field always runs away. So they tilt. So it means that these spins really tilt a little bit. But then big spins start precessing around these new spins. And that's roughly what these equations tell you. And interesting thing that if you just literally do this experiment, so you have a stick coupled to many spin 1/2 systems at zero temperature, and you measure this force, you find an integer. And integer is just total spin of your system. So it's like quantum Hall effect. I guess I still have a little bit of time, right? So let me just show, I told you how to measure Berry curvature. I said that you can measure this Chern number as a force, but let me just show about a particular sort of realization of this. We call it dynamical Hall effect, because there are now at least two experiments, and one is already successful in the lab trying to measure it. So it's like a different view on the quantum Hall effect. So basically, I told you that Coriolis force is given by Berry curvature times velocity. But if you have external, I mean, if you have dynamical degree of freedom, this Coriolis force is really Coriolis force. But if you have external field, let's suppose that you apply really massive external field, there is no feedback, then this is just generalized force. So for example, if you look into generalized force with respect to magnetic field, it will be just your magnetization. So what I'm telling you is that this magnetization will be equal to Berry curvature times the velocity. And in some sense, just let me point that normal quantum Hall effect is exactly part of this story. Because if I think about my electric field as rate of change of vector potential, then electric field is my velocity. If I think about response with respect to vector potential in other direction, then this is a current. And then current is equal to Hall conductivity times whatever electric field is precisely part of this story. But let me just tell you about another realization, again returning to this spin in the magnetic field. So normally, if someone will ask you how you measure Berry phase, you typically have adiabatic rotation and then interference, which is in some sense hard. At least it's not always possible. But what I'm telling that you can measure it a very different way. So it's like a dynamical way. So suppose we change, we just rotate magnetic field. Then we can change it linearly because clearly linear motions like stretching plus rotations. So we can rotate magnetic field. And then we measure this small magnetization, which I just explained the origin. We rotate magnetic field, spins are behind, so they start to tilt. So they will be tilt in orthogonal plane in y direction, which is proportional to angular velocity. So we divide this, and then the slope should be your Berry curvature. And after that, once you know it, you can calculate, say, Berry curvature in different points, and then take three-dimensional integral, you should get a Chern number. So just to be specific, let's assume that we have, again, spin 1/2 in linearly changing magnetic field. And then what we can do, we can go to instantaneous basis. And as I said, our wave function is almost the ground state, but there will be some small correction proportional to velocity. And you can compute it explicitly. It's a simple problem. And then you can just convince yourself that Y magnetization will be this velocity times precisely the Berry curvature. And this is how it looks numerically. So numerically, if you look into magnetization as a function of velocity, you just see that at small velocities it's linear. So this is the slope is precisely Berry curvature. So it means that you just measure magnetization as a function of velocity, divide by velocity, you find Berry curvature. And now if you integrate this Berry curvature over the sphere, you'll find 2 pi times integer. And in this case, you even don't need to integrate because you have rotational symmetry. So if you have rotational symmetry, then this integral just gives you 4 pi. It actually means that the ratio of magnetization over velocity is always equal to basically integer over 2. This h squared is just from dimensionality. So, and I'll finish with showing 2 examples. So how it can work in, spin 1/2 are nice, but it actually works in many body systems. So first I'll show you a Heisenberg chain. So this is similar to what I had before, but it's just interacting spins and then external magnetic field. So this model is sort of simple because total magnetization commutes with the Hamiltonian. So if you rotate magnetic field, which couples to total spin, so its dynamics is sort of decoupled. But it's still nice to look into response. And this is the plot, just some numerical results, for the slope which you measure. So I just said you measure magnetization in y direction, you divide it by velocity, and you find a slope. And what you find that the slope jumps by integers. And these integers, of course, correspond to the total spin of the system. But you can go to situations more complicated. So like, for example, this is a disordered chain where spin is still conserved, but magnetization no longer commutes with the Hamiltonian. And then if you still measure magnetization at small velocity and divide it by velocity, you'll still find this well-defined plateaus. So this is exactly like in Hall effect. You can go to situations when SU2 symmetry is broken, becomes even more interesting. So these integers are still there, but then you have to really integrate over the whole sphere. And these integers are adiabatically connected to the spin, but these are really your magnetic monopoles. So it's something which is like truly topological. Okay. So I'll finish about just maybe saying a few words about also related work, which is in progress and almost finished. I think it will appear in a month or something. So it's the idea, okay, what happens? I just discussed with you dynamics, and generic dynamics, slow dynamics. But we can ask, what happens near, say, phase transitions? Near phase transitions, as we argued, say, metric tensors or all susceptibilities have singularities, and therefore mass has singularity. And then it's actually a very interesting phenomenon which we found. This is work with Ami Katz, who is actually a high-energy theorist, which we can call dynamical localization. And roughly, without fine-tuning, roughly it works like this. So near the critical point, susceptibilities diverge. It means that your mass renormalization is infinite. So it's like, sort of, what is mass renormalization? It's like you're moving an object in space and it's dressed with low-energy excitations. That's what it is, right? That's very intuitive. But near the critical point, it's clear that you are going to regress a lot. But then imagine that you're throwing your macroscopic degree of freedom. So for Ami, it's, I guess, Higgs field, at least as a motivation. And, oh no, sorry, it's whatever, it's inflation field, which gives mass to Higgs boson. And anyway, so near the critical point where mass is zero, so you have gapless excitations, you're getting huge mass and huge dissipation. So it's very likely that near this point, system will stop. but just a natural. It's like if you think, suppose you have a wheel which just rotates, and at one spot of the wheel there is a bump where, say, friction is large. And you ask, so where this wheel will stop? Most likely near the bump. That's sort of kind of the story we see. Okay, let me finish with some conclusions. So I just said that we can use Fubini study metric to characterize phases and phase transitions. And the most important thing that metric tensor can be measured, this is usual dynamical response, which you see in all literature, structure factor, all this stuff. You just need to divide it by frequency squared, and that's it. So, and once you have your metric tensor, I mean, of course, calculating Gauss curvature is a little bit hard because you have to evaluate two more derivatives of metric tensor, and with noisy data, it's hard. But this invariants are very robust. So you can do easy embedding to, or find some smooth version of this metric and then evaluate, and all invariants should remain invariants. So I don't think it's really hopeless. So I argued that there are robust geometric invariants which characterizes phases and phase transitions. And in some sense, these invariants are more fundamental than susceptibilities, because susceptibilities do change under reparametrization. Well, these guys do not. The intrinsic property of your, if you want, of your phase, which don't depend on what parameters you use, h, h squared, what you fine tune, or whatever. These are really numbers which are completely robust. So they probably correspond to certain ratio of susceptibilities, but we couldn't figure this out. So we couldn't figure out how you can measure curvature directly. So this is an open problem. And then in the last part of the talk, I talk that actually Newtonian dynamics for macroscopic degrees of freedom is nothing but non-adiabatic expansion for macroscopic degree of freedom, which is coupled to some big system with fast degrees of freedom. In this sense, that notion of the mass is really temperature dependent, so it's not really universal. But mass has well-defined limit even at zero temperature. So that's probably what we will call fundamental mass. And this mass, at least in the classical limit, is related to the metric. So in the classical limit, inertial mass is given by this metric. In the quantum, they're different objects. So if you want to look more into like, you know, general relativity, whatever, we have to be careful. Maybe quantum gravity is not what people really think about. Maybe it's something completely different. And then I talked a little bit about extending quantum Hall effect, notion of quantum Hall effect to like SU2 situation, but you can extend it to pretty much any situation. As soon as you have time reversal symmetry breaking and two parameters which form closed manifolds, which can be some, I don't know, masses, couplings, whatever, then you can always find quantum Hall, and it can be measured as usual linear response. So of course it should be experimentally accessible, but there is no fine tuning or anything. Thank you.
So the equation for this emergent dynamics that you get, it has the sort of quantities, the masses, the soil, and so on.
Right.
And is there any kind of general way you can derive this, what is usually considered to be dynamics with scalar?
Yes, but I mean, you see, well, scalar mass is simple. So you just need to have orthogonal directions. So typically, if you have, so basically, if you're Hamiltonian, so this mass tensor of diagonal components of mass tensor really come from the fact that these guys sort of are not equal to zero. So if you have orthogonal directions, like which don't talk to each other, which is probably some related to symmetries of Hamiltonian, then you definitely get diagonal mass.
You mean something like you have a Cartesian coordinate?
For example, right. So for example, you know that from you have isotropic system, which is, yeah, isotropic system should be enough. And then you automatically know that all your directions should be like principal axes. So it's like with moment of inertia, right? So in general, it's really complicated object. But if you have symmetries, you know, just you see, say, okay, this direction must be in eigendirection, and this direction must be eigendirection.
Yes, but still, there, as a result, you receive something like a decoupled collection of equations, yes, like the system of equations, that there are few different masses.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
So
yes.
Like,
with respect to each degree of freedom.
Metaphor than actually
I don't know. It's macroscopic Hamiltonian dynamics. So at zero temperature, you can write macroscopic Hamiltonian, which is emergent in some sense. So you start, you say, I started from H naught, but as I said, H naught might not be even there, because this degree of freedom can be, say, average magnetization. So it's just really emergent. It just comes from, I don't know, average over collections of spins. But since it's macroscopic, it's classical. It's obvious. What happens in quantum limit is interesting, but I mean, it's one needs to think about this. So, and then you ask, what is dynamics? And then if you sort of know that dynamics of changing this magnetization is slower than dynamics of microscopic degrees of freedom, then you know by default it will be this type, I don't know, maybe you don't call it Newtonian, it's macroscopic Hamiltonian. Except that there is can be additional damping, which we know. But you know that damping, usually you don't do second order perturbation theory if first order is non-zero. But you see there is very, very different structure. Damping, first order, is always on shell. That means at small temperatures or whatever, it's something vanishes. While mass is off shell. So it means that there, you can imagine there are lots of situations, and all of them where you see under them dynamics, is where this order is important. But next order is not important already, because it's like certain derivative, it's again damping, except, for example, for light. Because we know, because of Lorentz invariance, there is no radiation proportional to velocity. So you have to go to lambda's ripple dot. So we didn't compute it, but I'm sure that, I mean, we have explicit expressions, but I'm sure that if you will find radiation pressure proportional to lambda's ripple dot, which is means that energy d dt is proportional to lambda double dot squared, right? So it's but it all appears as just non-adiabatic expansion. So I don't think it's coincidence. Well, it doesn't answer the question where it comes from if you don't know Hamiltonian. But it still tells you that you need very, very few parameters. Of course, the interesting thing, what will be interactions between the slow degrees of freedom? Because I said there is some generalized force and actually some mass. And mass can include interaction because this mass actually depends on parameters. And it can depend in a non-trivial way. So at the end, your dynamics, I call it Newtonian, but it's dynamics where mass can depend on parameters. So it can be very, very complicated dynamics. But it's described by still second order differential equations, which means that it's not as complicated.
So about this dynamical localization. So if you kick your system toward the critical point through macroscopic parameters that is coupled to your system, you said mass goes to infinite near the critical point.
Well, there are different. Okay. Yes.
So will the system will ever be able to go through the phase transition? Or
no, that's what I'm saying. There is a transition.
No matter how large the bareness.
Well, there is really a transition, so I can sort of elaborate more, but basically the idea is that there is a threshold velocity, which determines on the details. So if you're above this threshold, you will be able to go through. Well, just think about this, that your mass is truly big mass, and your system, it's order of limits. So suppose mass and system scale with volume, so it takes a thermodynamic limit, but mass per degree of freedom is huge. Then it's clear that you will pass it. And it will be probably UV sensitive, so you have some cutoff. But below a certain threshold, if velocity is slower than a certain threshold, system indeed will not be able to go through the critical point. It will just stuck. But it's interesting, dynamics we still don't understand quite, so we see slight overshooting, just very, very tiny overshooting, and then slow decay to zero. So and this overshooting we are trying to understand. So it's something we don't understand yet. So you can imagine that system asymptotically approaches critical point, but it's actually overshoots in this particular model and then approaches. But this we are talking about some very tiny effect we even don't know how to, there is no scale which we found for this. So this is some very, very small scale, and we don't really understand. But apart from that, if you look numerically, it's really sharp transition. So if you look in, for example, position of magnetic field after the first maximum, so in this oscillation, then you just see below a certain velocity, just 0, 0, 0, 0, and then shoots up. So it looks like true phase transition. At least it's very, very sharp.
Dissipation, right? So, do you have to assume that your system is coupled to
thermal path? No. But dissipation is interesting. It's on-shell process. Therefore, if you don't have, it's sort of interesting. It's on-shell, but it's determined by width, which is of the order of 1/T. So, if you have exponentially many levels, if you have ergodic system, then your dissipation is non-zero. But if you have discrete levels in non-ergodic system, then there is no dissipation in long time limit, just because there are no energy levels within the shell. So, and this is, I think Berry and Roberts, they first told that there is no, and their paper explicitly says that there is no dissipation at zero temperature. But I think they were in zero temperature, assuming there is a gap. If you have gapless system, this doesn't work, and then that's actually a sort of interesting interplay. But you'll never have standard dissipation, because you will either, if you have gapless system, you either have, you know, well, basically dissipation will be either zero if there are not enough states on shell, or it will diverge. So and then it means you have non-perturbative dynamics. Yeah, but this is related to ergodicity. Dissipation is definitely related to ergodicity. Yeah. So there will be corrections, sure. So there will be corrections in high-order derivatives, and this is generic. But I mean, I'm just saying that first two are really essential because they have very different structure. Then structure remains. So as soon as your degrees of freedom are fast compared to macroscopic degrees of freedom, then all these higher corrections will be strongly suppressed. But yeah, they're there. Well, for example, there are also corrections. We know that there is a drag proportional to v squared. If you move fast with your car, it's there. But it's next order. I mean, you have to work at high orders. It's more complicated.
All right. Any last question? So, if not,